So this is the second of our experimenter salons. And this time it's with Sarah Pusel, who made Confessions to the Mirror, and Ruth McLennan, who made Hero City. And I'm Helen DeWitt, one of the programmers of the experimenter sessions section of the festival. So the salons are intended to delve deeper into the artist's work and their motivations, and not have the restriction of the kind of standard Q&A setup, but be a more intimate conversation that involves you, the audience, as well. So please don't feel that you need to kind of wait to a Q&A session at the end. If you've got something to say, please kind of chip in immediately. So I'm going to just read a brief biog so you know who Sarah and Ruth are, and then I'm going to ask them to say a little bit about the work that they've got in the festival and relating it to previous work if they want to. And then I've just got a few themes that I'm going to kind of throw out to ask them to address or talk to each other about, and feel free to interject at any point with any questions or comments. So Sarah Pusel has been making 16mm short films since 1990, and they've shown in galleries and won awards at festivals internationally. Her films and photographs explore a sense of self which is transformative and fluid, and at the core of her practice is a concern with the materiality of the filmmaking process. The majority of her films take place within the confinements of domestic space, where the grounded reality of the house itself becomes a portal to a complex and multi-layered psychical realm. In her explorations of the animate and the inanimate, her work probes a journey between mirror and surface, in which questions of representation are negotiated via the feminine, the queer, or the dead. She has made many short works, and her first feature-length work in black and white, Magic Mirror, from 2013, premiered at Tate Modern and has toured internationally, and is also available on DVD, and she has exhibited photographs from the film at the Nunnery Gallery. Her sequel to Magic Mirror, Confessions to the Mirror, was screened here on Sunday, shot on 16mm, this time uses colour, and focuses on Claude Cahun's images set alongside her own text, Confidence au Mirror, which she wrote after her incarceration in World War II. And Sarah's a reader in art at Westminster University. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ruth McLennan completed Masters of Fine Art at Goldsmith College in 2000, and this is when she made her first videos in the dialogue series that explore dialogue as both verbal, literary, and cinematic form, with Socratic philosophical ambitions. While at Goldsmiths, together with the artist Volker Eichelmann, she produced the bookwork Style Substance, the Max Mara Coat Project, that explored the value of a fashionable coat and the circulation of ideas and images. She was awarded a Leave a Home Artist Residency in the Archives London School of Economics, and there she further explored how spoken language is performed and evolves through the use and the effects of architecture and design on behaviour. Her research into the archive led to a breakthrough film commission for the Wellcome Trust, We Saw It Like a Flash, A History of Genetics and Television, using BBC Archive from the 1950s to the present. And she collaborated with Uriel Orlo on a commission for the National Archives and the School of Advanced Study. So she's interested in landscape and traces of the past that are the focus of her films Capital and The Valley of Castles, which were both filmed in Kazakhstan, and Hero City, which was filmed in Russia, in Arctic Russia, that screened at the festival, is much like her other work in that it begins with an encounter with a place, and she focuses on overlooked moments, material realms, and fragments of stories that reveal unresolved conflict. And her work has shown internationally in exhibitions and film festivals, and is held in private and public collections. So would you both like to just talk a little bit about the Confessions to the Mirror and Hero City, to put a bit of context?
Yes, I've been making films since leaving the Slade in 1990. At that time, I found out about the artist Claude Cahun. Very important figure for me. I love her images. And then when I discovered her writing a lot later, it didn't get translated until 2007, the text that I work with in my, I've made two feature-length films on Cahoon. The first one is from Avenue on Avenue, which is disavowals, which is confessions, the translation very cryptic, kind of confessions annulled, confessions stopped. It's about telling the truth, confessions, but actually one's conscience won't allow you to, kind of. So it's a play sort of on that, about what is the truth. Yeah. So my first film was about this text, Avenue on Avenue, which is quite abstract. It's a collage of dream in the style of, you know, being inspired by Dada, Surrealism, dream, monologues, dialogues, poems, essay texts. So sort of that's the whole idea, that she doesn't want entities. She's looking at the relationship between entities and not trying to unfix how we categorize. Which I think she does that in every way, and that's why there's a particular relationship with maybe postmodern philosophy or even queerness.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, in terms of trans, she's very important because she's very experimental in the way she represents her gender. It's a non-fixed gender, sometimes elements of the feminine and elements of the masculine kind of co-present.
That's right.
And the
that's
use of masks, of course, to sort of like de-authenticize.
And so one of her key images, she sort of actually, I think, flattened her chest, and that's where she has the nipples on her, painted nipples on her shirt. So she's made herself look waistless and she's flattened herself. After all that in the 20s, she then had left in 1937 to go to Jersey. It's not quite clear, you know, obviously it was becoming very threatening to be there as a Jew, as a communist, as a anybody, an artist. A year after going to Jersey, the Nazis invaded the island. It was one in four of the population were Nazi, were officers. So it was like a house arrest there. And they engaged in propaganda activity solidly. And the work they had done in masquerade was really helpful. So they pretended to sort of everybody they were these frail ladies, Aryan widows, and they were dressed, and they really believed, oh, they're so frail, they're completely harmless. But their house was right next to the Nazi, it's a hotel, it was a hotel then, where the main headquarters, in a way. Mm-hmm. So they were, it was very, very dangerous what they did. They engaged in this for 4 years. Mm. One of her lines in it, I've got in the film, is, I was outside myself. It was the only way I could do it, to be kind of outside of myself for 4 years. And almost says later that the hardest thing she did, one of the lines that I have at the beginning of this film, which is, I was weak enough to undertake the impossible. Mm. And I love those lines. But actually the impossible is to write about it afterwards. So that's what I've
just. There was another line that I noted down. A path of revolutionary defeatism, which I really liked as well. The sense that you know that you can't do it, that you're not actually going to change everything, but you're going to kick up a fuss and you're not going to get over it.
Revolutionary defeatism is an understood idea that people participated in, which means it's the lower classes who in wars don't benefit, whichever nation wins.
Yeah.
So it was that thing. Yeah, that's what she was involved in. International, what was it? International defeatism. That actually it's a looking at class, and this is what a big thing that happened after the First World War. They realise actually those ones fighting at they're not getting anything out of it, even if their side wins. Mm. They're not going to get anything out of it anyway. Who wins out of that?
Yeah, you go back to unemployment.
And that was her class consciousness, and that's very important about what happened when she was in Jersey, that it was an appeal. The messages weren't like anti-Nazi, it was actually an appeal to the German soldiers. She always called them German soldiers, who actually didn't want to be there, saying, look, actually, you're not going to get anything out of this. Hitler doesn't care for you, and that's what she uses in the propaganda. Mm. He's just eating for you, he's speaking for you, he's just going to eat you. The key
Nazi
really figures, they are brilliant. I mean, the propaganda lines were really clever in a way, weren't they? So it was that appeal to the German soldiers, and when they were imprisoned with German soldiers who were actually getting out and being shot, they were on the same side, and she felt very happy. And one of the soldiers had actually given her the insignia that she puts in her mouth later in that image.
Oh,
that's what it is, and it's also like the cat has got something, and that's why I put the sound of the cat kind of. So it was an appeal. She felt she had achieved just something in that, because otherwise she was broken. She'd broken by the experience, really, and wasn't really well physically, mentally, almost, after when they came out. She did feel that that was a kind of winning thing, that it was an appeal. Mm. That's what she was trying to do. It wasn't, she was trying to think again in this way, that it wasn't one nation on another, mm. but actually the people who were being exploited. Mm. And there was just so much what happened in World War
I. Yeah, absolutely.
And that was almost, I found, you know, part of what started a kind of socialist thinking, like who wins that? So that's all to summarise that. What I have done to summarise in both projects is to restage. If you know her work, you see my film differently. Mm. All of those black and white, but that's why at the beginning of the film I say, as well as telling this story, I say, the film constitute restagings of her still lives, all those still lives were restaged of her images. So I'm kind of, in a way, I'm collaging, and maybe this is where there's connections with what you've been doing, Ruth, of maybe collaging from an archive. I don't use the archive, I always restage everything completely. And there's a labour intensity in there that's, I don't know, a bit crazy, or is also kind of invisible as well, if you don't know. But that kind of interests me, in a way. In some ways, it's taken me longer to make the images, maybe, than it did Cahoon, because she was just saying this one or that one. I'm actually having to get the same, trying to get it in.
Study it and then recreate it.
Find it, and from whatever's hanging around, and that was part of my aesthetic, whatever's hanging around. And you can still see my interior space, the domestic home, which is where I've made a lot of my work before. And in Magic Mirror, I didn't have the opportunity, my first film on Cahoon, to show that I had made this in a small space, my domestic home. I wanted to sort of inscribe that in this film, that you would see the home, but also see me, and to show me tracing, copying her words, copying that she wrote, tracing the drawing they did in the prison. And so what happened, because of that method, was I started to restage the poses and the copying and the tracing, both of, in order to make the piece make sense, their photographs, I say her there, because her partner helped do them, their photographs, which was their art, as well as their work. In order to make the film make sense, I ended up restaging, putting the propaganda in the Nazi coat pockets, putting them in the windscreen, going to the car, or restaging those gestures in a way, so it got mixed up. So that's what I've done, and I've put that alongside her text, which is her final text. It wasn't actually her final, I didn't get to say that. It was next to her final, Confessions to the Mirror, which may have been a follow-up from Disavowals, because they've both got the word confessions in. Confessions denied, and then Confessions to the Mirror, where she describes what happened in Jersey, but it's more first person, it's also her... It's also quite juxtaposing of personal. It describes her personal trauma as a child. She's put that in, where her mother was incarcerated because she had mixed parentage, which at that time was pretty crazy. Her mother was Catholic, her father was Jewish, which was very unusual then. And her mother was actually in a mental home all her life. And when she was young, it kicked Cahoon, and that's why she'd been found in parts of furniture around the house.
Oh, really?
That's part of the story, and that's why I tried to just bring that in.
Yeah.
And so I suppose there's all these hidden little, and that's sort of what made me think why she's got this image of her. Beauty. It's one of my favourite images of her hidden in the cupboard.
Yes.
It's
my favourite.
As a little doll.
Yes.
It's just, I love the image.
It's extraordinary, that picture.
It's beautiful.
It's funny how we found, because I wrote about Cahoon in my undergraduate dissertation. I remember it being complete. There was a show at the ICA in the early 90s.
I went to that.
Yeah. And that really affected me so much. And that picture, particularly, because I was also making things about cupboards at the time.
Yeah.
Always, the child and made things inside cupboards, like made little houses underneath the sink in my bedroom. And in all over the place. that image is extraordinary. And one of the things I was thinking, just picking up, that idea of disavowal, I think is extremely interesting. And sorry, I don't mean to interrupt now.
I was just going to say that image, again, was just used by Michelle Williams-Gamaker, who's just won the Experimental Pitch Prize in her, and the image from your film that she had on a slide. which we don't mind.
Oh, that's nice. No.
Because yeah, which she was sort of weaving into her new work, which is called hyper. Thank you, hypertorid. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll just say one thing going back to that, and then I kind of come round it, and that's that. In this, what has become then an intense experience time for me, of going through Cahoon's images and these two texts, I've been interested to look at the relation between, well, partly bits of her life and her images and her texts. So the line I put with that was, you know, when, I can't remember what I put about almost wanting to be alone, something like that, wasn't it? It's about something wanting to be alone and the peace of that, the peace of her dreams. And so it's been the process of collaging her images, her words, and how I think image is somehow connected then with my reading of her work. And what happens when you read, when I say read, I mean read images, reading of her work, listening to the words, looking at the images, and while I'm doing that, I'm projecting something, of course, probably, but that I like to think that this process of reading or listening is a creative process. And somewhere in my press release thing, I put something like the space between creating something and receiving, listening, looking, interpreting, it's not so hard. And I like that idea that process, because it's one is creative when one interprets, because it also comes down to the translation literally of the words, the translation of what does she mean by that, and what trying to translate, and also how you try to translate from a different time. If I restage, what am I trying to translate? I'm trying to understand, but in order to do that, I'm creating something. And I just like that idea that there's something happening there in the way that, say, if you're a musician in band or something, listening is really important, rather than everybody just talking and something like that, and not listening or wanting to show, but actually that interrelation, and to put emphasis onto that, and also then think about authorship as kind of, well, never mind about that, but it's somehow that comes into something like that. But that's important, and part of that idea is also then going into her work, where the gap between word and image, but also I'm using movement and sound. Is I've been interested to think how I can get behind her images or behind the words to a part of Cahoon that's actually behind, or something like that. I don't know. So, something like that. That's the kind of point of.
So, you know, Ruth, your work, thank you, Sarah, that was very. There's a lot in there, and it was very full, and we can explore some of those ideas in a moment. But, Ruth, you're on the surface. Your work would appear to be diametrically opposed, and is set in the real world, and is and has as a narrator telling their interpretation. However, that's not how the work.
Sorry.
Not at all the story. It's in a sense it may look like that's the case, but in fact everything is created again. You're unspecific about the city in Hero City. You filmed it in more than one place. The story the narrator is telling, you're unsure of its veracity or its origins or its authenticity. You're unsure about who the narrator is and why they're there and what the story is. So in a sense, from what appears to that you could interpret in a quite straightforward way, has a similar level of depth to Sarah's work in terms of where do you begin the investigation to kind of understand where you are, who you're with, why you're there, what the histories are, what the stories are, and how to interpret.
I guess,
them.
I mean, in a way, one of the questions also is like sort of when are you there, as opposed to even where you are.
Do you want to just
describe the film. So it's. It's in this city in the Arctic Circle. I mean, it's mainly shot in Murmansk, which is high up in the Arctic Circle, and in the summer, so there's no snow anywhere. You couldn't tell that it's the Arctic, unless you knew. And Hero City is the name that's given to cities that fought in the Second World War in the Soviet Union. So they were known as Gorod Geroy, Hero City. And St. Petersburg, Leningrad was also a hero city, and there are shot there is part of it is shot in Leningrad. And so the images are quite well, they're handheld shot, you know, well, with my monopod, my kit that I go out when I'm like on my own, which I'm usually am. I'm often the one man band, one woman band, with as much as I can carry and no more sound recording and interviewing people. But I mean, that method actually does matter in a way in this film quite a bit, because you can't, you would film in a different way if you had a tripod and you were not traveling around and you had someone else to do sound recording. And we talked a little bit about that before today, about actually so you also have that sense of somebody in particular, somebody filming. It's not just filmed, it's not just like the object, somehow the objective camera, that it is filmed from some point of view. And the, in a way, I assume that the voice of the narrator is the same as the filmmaker. So the I, it's in the first person, the monologue, and it's the woman's voice. And I kind of assume that it's the filmmaker speaking, but not speaking at the time of the filming, but coming back and looking back at the footage much, much later. So she talks in the past, but in the first person, but in the past. But sometimes he talks to the images and sort of is describing what you see. But then sometimes, then there comes points where you're like, huh, that's not possible, where she's describing. So she goes to a museum, or the images go to a museum, and you see the different exhibits in the museum, and she's describing different things, not what you see. Because in the description, in the voiceover, the museum is empty and doesn't have anything there, because the museum that I visited in Murmansk, well, it doesn't really matter, but anyway, the museum I visited in Murmansk had hardly anything in it except for this kiosk. And I describe all the things in this kiosk, or the eye describes all the things in the kiosk. But of course I've invented, those things are invented. So the fridge magnet that gradually drags the fridge towards the magnetic pole.
That's such a brilliant image.
So that is key, that of course, of kind of unreliability or you know, lunacy, I mean, or whatever. I mean, there's something going wrong here, that this is not really real. But at the same time, you are very much aware of the material that you're seeing, and you're seeing a lot of things, and you're having lots of lists of things as well. So those objects and the, you know, the exhibits that you see are sort of like as a stuffed polar bear and lots of stuffed, different stuffed animals and Arctic figures, sort of Inuit carvings and stuff. And it's, in a way, that museum is quite a key part of the, that museum footage shot part of it is quite important. And it was shot in the Museum of the Arctic and Antarctica in St. Petersburg, which is now St. Petersburg. It was made in Leningrad. The museum opened in 1937, which is the height of Stalinist terror. It's pretty much the same as it was in 1937. I don't think it very much has changed. I mean, there was the occasional in the entrance, they might add something, and you've got more recent photograph. There's an aeroplane that flew over the Arctic, right? And there are all these Arctic heroes, sort of Arctic explorers. The Arctic was the first sort of frontier in the Soviet Union, that, and it's in the 20s, and the hero, the people who flew over the Arctic were, or, you know, the explorers that went to the Arctic were really sort of trumpeted as heroes. And they were quite useful because they were not political. Because of course it's meant to be communism, so you're not meant to have heroes. Everyone's meant to be equal. But you need heroes, or Stalinism needs heroes. So pilots are quite good because they don't speak very much and they do stuff. They fly, and that's kind of, you know. So that museum, and it's also, instead of instead of angels in the frescoes, you've got scenes of Stalin or Lenin meeting Arctic explorers, or just like bunches of people gathering in frescoes in big and arches. And I mean, it's quite a chilling sort of place actually. I've also got these amazing sort of vitrines of scenes of the Arctic. So I've got a postcard actually. I haven't got the book, but anyway, that's one of the, that's the sort of image that I used in a think it's one that's on the
screening. Yeah.
But, anyway, so and the music, there's a, the soundtrack at that point. I use music, kind of sporadically in the film, and some of the music I use for the shots around the museum, but in other parts of it is from the film Aerograd by Dovzhenko, the Soviet Ukrainian director who also made Earth, which is a more famous than Aerograd, a really amazing film. And the film is 1935. Yeah. It's really it's shot in this kind of taiga. It's in the forest. But it's about founding a city in the Arctic called Aerograd. Air city. It's not air for nothing, as I was saying. All this about pilots and Chekhov. There's this pilot you see in the film as well. But the city actually doesn't actually exist yet. And that's the sort of supreme irony of the film. But I won't go and tell you about the whole film of Aerograd, because you can always go and watch it. It's online. With subtitles, a very, very poor copy. You can actually watch it at the BFI in Stephen Street. I watched it. I got out the film reel, and I went and watched it with a Russian friend because I didn't want to miss anything. And it was actually really nice to have her there, because it's really bleakly Stalinist as well, and it's really brutal. The peasant hero goes around shooting people because they're enemies of the people, and it's like a really, really particularly objectionable xenophobe.
Values of his early films and solidarity with people and the great joy of life on the land.
Well, it's funny because in a way, although that side, it is absolutely horrific, at the same time that the last scenes where all these pilots jump out of airplanes with their parachutes and they land in Aerograd, it's quite surreal. I mean, it really, in the literal sense, it's surrealist. And then there's this sort of Inuit kind of Nanook of the North type character who comes. He's been there all the way through on his own, so individual. Mm. Unlike the Soviet heroes, he's not a sailor, he's not a pilot, he's not a peasant. He's a little native, but in that awful kind of way of Nanook of the North. However, he gets there and he's like, "Where's Aerograd?" Mm-hmm. And he's like, "Oh, we've got to make it. We've got to build it." And it's just like this supreme irony that he's managed to introduce into the film, which is like, in a way, kind of totally makes the whole thing sort of disintegrate. But of course, it wasn't noticed, or he got away with it, or it's sufficiently ambivalent and that he got away with it. So the film is not kind of resolvable in a way. It's not anything like as good, bad, is impossible to say, but it's a pretty incredible film visually, especially that last bit and all the aerial filming in it. But so I use some of the heroic music from that as a kind of, in a way, sort of to link it. But I know that no one's going to know that music is from Aerograd, because no one's seen Aerograd except for very few people, I think. But it's that kind of heroic music which you could hear in another film of that time. So let me jump quickly to the film more as a whole. The character, the monologue person in the monologue is looking back at this footage and seeing and saying, especially towards the end of the film, saying, why couldn't I see what was clearly there? What could I not find in those images? Why did I not see in those images what was to come? I should have known. I should have known better. I should have known what was to come from that. But you never know what that is. What that was to come, because she's after that moment. We're now after the terrible things that have happened, but we don't know what those terrible things are because we don't see it. But we hear what she says. But what she says is very metaphorical rather than literal. But it's somehow connected to kind of military build-up or the kind of climatic apocalypse. She does describe the things that we're being told are going to happen. So the ice. Well, and we're not just being told they really are likely to happen, but we are being told them that are going to happen. So the melting of the ice, of the Arctic ice, the opening of the Northern Sea Route, which is already sort of happening, the build-up, the military build-up, that is actually happening. In fact, it's much worse now than it was when I was in the Arctic filming this in 2013. So all the things, you know, and then you don't hear exactly, you know, you don't know what happened, but somehow there's this kind of post-apocalyptic sort of situation. But yeah, so when I want to come back to that idea, this is, that's basically the summary of the plot, what there is of a plot. It's not really a plot at all. There's no plot. It's kind of more like a vertical plot. It's like a layer and another layer, kind of which your films as well. There's no plot as such, or the plot doesn't, I wouldn't say, or at least it's not a kind of.
But it's a kind of sort of building. It's a building atmosphere, and a simultaneous kind of. In both your films, in a sense, you're feeling you're gaining more information, and you're enjoying the very interesting visuals. But at the same time, it's creating more and more mystery. So the more you learn, the more
there is to know.
Yeah. The more kind of perplexed you are, but in an enticing way, not a frustrating way. It's just like it draws you in a way that draws you more and more in.
Well, so, this film in particular, I'd say, in my films, I was really. I mean, it came out of a lot of research I've been doing in the Arctic and what's happening in the Arctic. And I made another film that was shown here 2 years ago called Call of North, which I shot in the Russian Arctic. It's quite a different sort of film. I won't really talk about that much, but it's sort of looking at experiences of climate change. But then you don't see very many people in it. It's just other people's voices talking. And so it's kind of like a sort of polyphony. It's kind of almost like a piece of music, I think of it in a kind of quite that sort of compositional way. But in this film, I really was thinking of it, and it was almost a kind of philosophical, kind of ethical, but ethical, philosophical, ecological kind of struggle. I was trying to work out, you know, what I was trying to figure out, you know, what will people think looking back at now, you know, in 20, 30, 50, 100 years' time, what will they be thinking about why we did nothing or we didn't do very much? And then thinking, well, what can I do I'm an artist, you know, I write, I make films, I do performances, I do whatever I do, anyway, and alongside lots of other artists doing. What will people think looking back at whatever survives of that art, whatever, if anything, but, you know, what will they think about what we were thinking? How are we responding to this situation? How, you know, how were we really questioning it? Because the sign that there are humans in the world, as opposed to apes, is drawing on and carving on rocks in caves, or little, you know, rock carvings or whatever. So, and they reflect partly, we think anyway, we assume they reflect the environment in which they are found, or, you know, the animals they were shooting, or not shooting, obviously, you know, spearing or whatever, or not, or, you know, so there is a kind of the sense, like, you know, how am I making sense of this? How do I make sense of this kind of ridiculous situation? And, you know, what am I doing with this? You know, how do I? So even going to Murmansk in the first place was a sort of, I sort of added it on to the end of the journey for making that other film, because I wanted to go to Aerograd. I've seen Aerograd. I want to go to Aerograd. Of course, Aerograd exists. It's all these cities in the Arctic. Most people who live in the Arctic live in cities. They don't live in igloos. See, no one lives in an igloo anymore. If they ever did, they probably lived in other kinds of. So I wanted to go to Aerograd, so I went to Aerograd. I speak Russian, by the way, so that makes it a lot easier to kind of, it's the only way you could ever do it. So the voice is a traveler, the person in the film is also a kind of visitor, because I also didn't want to be like making a film about other people. It's not like a film about other people's problems. I'm not going there and saying, yeah, come on, yeah. Put your stuff together.
Question.
Yeah.
No. first question, my part of this is very language based research, is firstly the idea of what is it around the media that specifically you're bringing to the show? And if there's evidence you're going to have to work in this area, which is highly part based work, uniquely working on the system now. Most people don't have this field of stuff. The second part of that question relates to what you said just now, which is why I interrupted you at that point, going back to something that you were intimating yourself, is this idea of ethos. So what is the work doing in the world? So firstly, how are we doing what we need to do? What is it really, the strategy that we need to do? What is it doing? What is it asking us? What is it asking us to complete? Or, as an idea, what is it doing in the world? Do we think, I mean, obviously, I'm going to do my world, but we think this is a valuable thing. And I think it's very important to talk about, particularly when we're saying, Magnus and Harvey Gears.
Well, exactly. I said 20.
Will anyone be here then? That was my thought.
I'm not thinking that my work is going to survive 100 years, but I just mean whatever is found in however many years.
The idea of ethos, but how is it?
Okay.
What is it asking of us? And what is it asking of us to think of and think back?
I'll just try, because.
Yeah.
The longer you go, I might not be able to speak. I'll try. Shall I go? Shall I try?
Okay, go. I'll try afterwards. Yeah.
I suppose I think this is a really important, great question. all I can say is there this urgency about what's happening, what are the things I'm trying to get at. So I'll have to sort of break it into bits because I haven't got a singular great line. There'll be bits. One is about listening and think, I'm interested in what film can do as a medium, because you asked about film. What film can do as a medium when an artist has died and left photographs and writing. I can animate it, I can bring it into the present. This is something that concerns me over and above my whatever with Cahoon. Actually, as a filmmaker, I can do this, I can pick up these photographs, I can bring them into the now, I can look at the text, I can look behind her text and her images, I'm hoping, and bring that into now, and animate it and breathe life into that voice that couldn't be heard in her own time, to reflect on what artists speaking now can't be heard in their own time. At the end of my film, I write a credit to Sandra Lahia, who was a filmmaker. She was my partner, but she was also a mentor for me, I think for you, sir. And since she's died, I think the BFI might be doing something if you're... But yep. Nothing has been shown of her film since she died in 2001. She was making important work, political work. There's what we can access in terms of what an artist is saying and what we can't access. What's getting channeled around all over the time, over and over. I go abroad, I think, I'll go to the galleries. That's in London. Oh, St. Mars, that's in London. I can't, and yet there are artists really important, making really important work. I don't get to see them. And I think this reflects the wider economic climate where we've got the high street corporations because there's money involved. So my reflection to turn to Cahoon, to turn to Sandra, is look at these other voices. Think about that. Think about those voices that can't be heard because they've got so much to say. Cahoon knew this, which I think is so brilliant. She described herself as Cassandra. She was furious that her text, her text, Avon on Avenue, was given very negative reviews. She was bitter and scathing her writing. That's what the literary criticism decided to do with this Cassandra. Cassandra being the myth of the goddess who is gifted with seeing into the future. So she knows that, this postmodern philosophy.
I think it is the archetype of the artist, though, that as the seer. I mean, there are an awful lot of artists who are seeing into the future, you know, and then whatever it is they saw in the future.
Well, yes, that's why I'm not just saying it to her. So that's why I'm using this as an example.
It's a brilliant example.
But is punished for this gift because she won't sleep with the guy goddess, actually. Of course, so she's gay. So She's punished for that, and the punishment is no one will believe her. So no, I just think that is amazing, and it's so partly it's a call to that, it's a call to think about that. On issues also, to reflect on, I think this story is important about war and non-war times, what an artist does in war, what an artist does not, how I can't think of the word, of her surrealist circle who criticised her for not being materialist, not being a proper Marxist, but then when the war came, they didn't do anything. Mm. But they were searching for fame. There's some scathing, her close friend Robert Desnos, who died in the camp, the poet, wrote something scathing about Breton. Mm-hmm. You know, and they're the ones, and we still go to the galleries, and they're all here, Tristan Tzara. Yeah. They were just saying to the Nazis, get rid of that one, send that one to the camp. Mm-hmm. We don't even hear about this, mm-hmm. but this is what happened. So to think about what happens, and what Kahuna's done is talked about her personal life, talked about, it's not separate, as we know from the feminist slogan, her personal life with her mother, that is also political, it's all, everything is, so she didn't, I wanted to sort of not separate that, so the sort of taboo around some figuration or propaganda, to actually try and play with this film compared to my last one is more, it's got a story, or I don't know whether it has, but it has a little bit more. I do, because of the seriousness of the fact of what they did and being imprisoned and committing suicide because they thought they'd be sent to a camp, because of the seriousness of it, I had to readjust how I made the film, and it became slower and more just, I had to just honour that and allow the audience to know that's what the story was and not be confused of not knowing. So, to solve this problem of not wanting to make a drama out of someone's life, which would be horrible, I tell the story at the beginning, the key points, and it's not the story. They're like six lines of sentences. It's not the story, it's a whole load of others, but you could say they're key bits. And then the film actually covers those key bits, like, oh, but I already know that. You're not giving new bits, you're giving the sentences, and it's almost to sort of break that up. But perhaps I've gone off the point, but the point about that's important, but to think about, all I can do is for us to reflect and think about what's personal, how we act even ethically in a way, not just politically, but in all our ways, how we are together, what are we doing, that's what I'd like to do. I don't think I'd do that in the film.
Politics can't be effective if you're not being ethical. Yeah. I mean, it's it's otherwise you're talking.
Yes, but one can put a name as what happened, which is I am this. You do it as a slogan, as a label, and you get it
that
happens
all the time.
And that's for this, to reflect on that. To reflect on this,
absolutely,
on that story.
And I think that, I mean,
to
I think
question it,
because
I think it gets
important.
Blindedly not absolutely. Questioned. You know, you just state you're this, and you get the label. And
I mean, I think that question, the question of, you know, of propaganda or of meaning that, you know, that a work might have a particular, of, you know, message in it as well. No, I know you didn't mean it like that. Yes, no, I know you did. No, I know you didn't. I was just picking up on that word of propaganda.
It's because I said it.
It's because you
did,
yeah. No, but I think a critique of it. Yeah. Yeah, no, but I think actually, I mean, maybe it's because I, you know, lost causes, I think, are quite interesting. But, you know, that looking back at how, I mean, the Soviet Union and the kind of, there's also a very dangerous moment right now, which is what's going on in Russia and what's going on in relation between, you know, and the kind of what's happened to politics and how it's become very, very extreme, even when it's just speaking in a very extreme way. I mean, we've seen it here with all the everything around Brexit, but before that, around the Scottish referendum for independence. We just need a jug. It's like real water.
I said a jug. Coming to deal with new tin technology. Thanks.
You know, and then Trump. I mean, I didn't want to go over these again because it's just. But that sense of just, you know, oversimplification and hate and, you know, just like on a kind of really extreme, and really basic, and really dangerous, and also not ever thinking really of the consequences of what you say. Yeah. And that's kind of happening a lot. I mean, in Russia as well, what's, you know, Putin, and having gone there before Ukraine was, before Crimea was annexed. In fact, I made a film in Ukraine, which is on at the moment. In fact, it's a little plug. Then going right after Crimea was annexed, and the change in attitudes towards Putin, indifferent towards what was going on is absolutely because of the endless propaganda. But again, it's saying a lot of untruths peppered with a few things which are plausible, which is what, you know, so people take it. And that is what happened. That's what is happening an awful lot. Even that happened here. That happened to Trump. That happened here. With our, you know, I mean, the consequences are perhaps not quite as dramatic as
it's all kind of that information and how that's conveyed, isn't it?
And sort of cults of personality. But the other thing, going back, I think this thing, in a way, we're both looking back at this 1930s moment as well, in a way, which is because. In some ways, I mean,
obviously
we're looking at right now.
Scary that is.
Really scary, absolutely. And why we are. I mean, maybe we didn't think, perhaps necessarily, we're thinking, oh, we're going to look at the 30s because we're about to relive the 30s. I didn't think like that at all. It's just that those are the things that are, you know. The things that we're looking at are in the present. I mean, we're looking at Claude Cahun's photographs, but they still exist now. So they're speaking to us as material that exists now. They were taken then, but they are now. The museum that I went to, it was made in the 30s, but those things are still, you know, moth-eaten stuff, polar bears, are still there now, and they have children going around them right now, and they mean something right now, and why are they looking at them in this particular way? And that city was not built, you know, it wasn't only built, Murmansk wasn't only built in the 30s, but it still got all, you know, and they had recently put up a monument actually to the, I forget what they call it, but you know, the ships that came during the British ships that brought supplies during the Second World War through Murmansk, and a lot of them were sunk by U-boats. But there's a monument to that just recently, in like 2013, it has been opened there. Kind of probably the last friendly thing that's happened between Russia and Britain, actually. To come back to that idea of the ethos. I guess one of the things is like making a film that is, and writing that, or, you know, bringing the thing together, that they don't, you know, neither illustrates the other. The text doesn't illustrate the images, or, but that you, there's always a kind of, there are lots of gaps, or like there's a sense that you do actually have to work as a viewer, and that you're not going to resolve any of the, there's no kind of resolution that's possible. But at the same time, it's not just like utterly mystifying, so you are like, not interested in a way, or that you can just like bear, you know, swim in beautiful images or something. But that there's stuff to hold on to, but there are so many associations and so many, you know, I guess it's about complexity in a way.
Layering.
Yeah.
And that can happen in different ways. Because
it happens
actually,
very much in your film,
in
and
some
I had that
ways,
a lot watching your film.
Yes.
About one of the things that I really enjoyed about watching. Your film were I mean, one, I do know her work quite well because I read about it for my little baby dissertation a long time ago.
Yeah.
And so, but I really enjoyed coming back to that. But also that, you know, the other associations that have come to it in the, you know, the 20 years since I looked at those images, and the kind of contemporary associations that come to it, and the sort of, you know, the those lines and how that some of the lines that you quote, you know, and I also found sort of threads of connection between when all that talk about projection and the idea that you project into images, which of course I do all the time as well. I mean, but I've also worked with projection on buildings, of projecting back the place, project something I've filmed in a particular place, projecting it into that place again, and that so that the viewer is both. Is in that kind of uncanny sense of like they're separate. When you're watching a film, you're kind of in that space of the film, but then if that film is also in, if you're also in the space in which that film was made, then you have that kind of uncanny feeling of, you know, where do I fit in that? And so that was really interesting to me. And also this thing, the relationship between the still image and, sorry, I'm jumping around and bringing lots of different things here but there's something I was thinking about that relation, that kind of reanimating of a still image. Because another film I made, I'm obviously kind of the 30s, going to come back again, was a quite a long time ago when I was in the LSE in the archive. There was an archive of the National Institute of Industrial Psychology, which is a really fascinating organization that that came out of the First World War, and it was looking to improve working conditions in factories, but also to improve productivity. But, you know, there are these photographs in the Webb archive, because the Webbs were Beatrice and Sidney Webb, were Fabians and helped set up the LSE, and they were they visited the Soviet Union in 1933, and they were shown around. They were shown, you know, how wonderful it was, and they completely swallowed how wonderful it was. And there's like a photograph of women being led through exercises in a shop in Leningrad, you know, doing sort of calisthenics, you know, exercises. And there's another photograph from 1933 in the same archive of women, again, being led through exercises at the Roundtree factory. Same exercises. Also, same kind of photograph. Mm. So I did a performance of exercises in the LSE, in the corporate sort of atrium, which is meant to be the student services building, but it's just like a kind of corporate office. I mean, it's horrendous, and everyone's working behind a glass. It was some years ago now. Well, only 10, actually, so a bit more. But it was, again, that was sort of reanimating, appropriating that image and seeing what had happened to that moment of, you know, let's keep our workers fit so that they are better workers and better cogs in the labour machine. Yeah. And, you know, and what's happened now, it's been privatised, so you spend your own money on the gym.
Going to the gym.
Yes. You do it in your own time instead of the factory time. Yeah. And, but then there's also kind of ambivalence there, because it's actually quite pleasurable to do a dance class with a whole lot of other people and do exercises together. And, and there's a kind of pleasure in being part of a mass of people. And so that kind of, so from, anyway, I was just thinking about that thing of reanimating what you do.
Yeah, I was
doing.
Just thinking,
so you're taking
my
a still image into the...
The moment you animate an image, you are speaking about your reading. Your reading is becoming a creative thing. That very process of animating.
Yeah.
So that's kind of interesting.
It really makes you think it through again, because think through the image, making of that image.
I mean,
as well.
Makes you think as you watch it, how do you read it? Because what you're doing is sort of not forcing, but let's could say forcing your viewer, your audience, to kind of then see that, how you're doing it. Yeah. But that's kind of okay, because you're sharing
reinterpreting
it.
But almost like resurrecting.
Resurrecting is important. Yeah. Resurrecting's really important. Mm. You're actually, because when we talk through rational language, we separate this past-present, which is an artificial, we only have the present, and the past is always with us. At the moment it's there. It's just an idea that it's, well, it is there, but it's only just that makes path makes it's sense,
taboo.
Doesn't it?
You never live in the past, you always live in the present.
Yeah, because people say this taboo thing, like, actually, baggage, about, oh, you're living in the past, and you are, like, you're told off for it. Or like, no,
pathetic.
I'm living in the future. But they're all fantasy world anyway. Yeah. You know, it's all kind of, they're all words that do and don't mean,
conceptions.
Mean so much.
I mean, we know that other cultures have very different views of the past, temporal,
I wanted to pick up just something tiny about complexity and this, because I was worried all the way through my film, through both of my film projects, because I loved all of Cahoon's writing and I didn't want to take it out. But so I illustrate her words, and I've done that here. I said, oh, taboo word, illustrate. But I wanted to. And then I wanted her line as well, but often I had to take it out because people will... Someone, you know, people have said, oh, that's just terrible to do that. And I'm thinking, why do I want... I sort of, some things like the Dutch housewife, they're great lines I took out because I thought, well, I've given a Dutch housewife.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Whatever.
You
so I had
it.
To.
Yeah.
But, so it's difficult because I'm close. What was I going to say there? Part of it is about, maybe this is about the thing we talked about materiality, embodiment, and this notion of self. And so for me, it's been quite important to actually sort of perform and know that I'm performing. We talked about the I. What is the I? What is it truth to pretend you're someone else or to be yourself? Or what does it mean? Can I just be myself? Is it always a pretend? If I sort of say, oh, I did that in my home and that's me. And but it is, for me, it is a kind of story about me, even if that's projecting. And I sort of want to offer myself in a way as a vessel. You're saying, Laura Marvid said, described me as a ventriloquist, as a vessel or something to perform this, almost as maybe as a vessel for a viewer to kind of think what this journey is of tracing and everything, whatever.
Well, thinking about the way, you know, about that I mean, I think, and again, it goes back to, in a way, to that ethos, the idea of the ethos. I think if I have an ethic, obviously I have an ethic, everyone has an ethic, whether they know they have one or not. But
some people
seem to be pretty rotten in there.
I don't think everybody does. I don't think Trump has.
That depends on your definition of ethic. Well, okay, ethics don't have to be ethical.
Ethic can be wretched as well.
As a plural, rather than the concept. Anyway.
I don't mean like, you know, I'm so great. You know, I don't mean that at all. I just mean that the sense of, there is a putting oneself in the way of things, and a kind of, I think in the way that I, at least not, this doesn't happen with all the work, or probably does actually now, but it's sort of come to this over time, but I've been going to places like going to Murmansk or going to the Arctic Circle to this village or going to Kazakhstan. I haven't gone on like some, you know, really tough expedition, you know, where I've had to, you know, I've worn the same pair of boots the whole time. To buy a special kit or anything. You know, I haven't had to brave the elements particularly. But there's that sense of vulnerability and of being kind of open to what happens and to following what messages are coming to me, and that comes across, I think, in the work that I'm doing, perhaps. I don't know, maybe it doesn't, but certainly that is a very key point of, and a kind of, in a way, that sort of, it's not exactly investigative, because investigative makes it sound like some kind of detective who goes out, and it's not like that. It's more being a kind of sponge as well, of like, and maybe it's something to do with being a linguist, often being on the side and listening to what different people are saying, and then trying to make people communicate with each other. It's like, no, you haven't quite understood, let me translate, you know, or like, and there you're not speaking, and okay, that's a kind of ventriloquist in a way, because you're not speaking for yourself, you're speaking for others, you're trying to enable people to speak, to be able to understand each other, to make connections. Yeah. And sometimes, like, this project's part of a bigger project, which is it's ended up in a PhD, which I've submitted. So I interviewed a lot of people, and I had conversations with a lot of people, and some of them were more like interviews, but mainly they weren't like interviews. It's more like sort of just being an ear, and then actually people want to talk, and because you've come from somewhere else, you're like the shrink who doesn't, no one's gonna, you don't have, there's no consequences to talking to me. I mean, I've always said what I'm doing. I'm making a film, but, you know, I won't mention your name if you don't want me to. And, you know, it's never. But, you know, it's always like there's that sense of like, I can spill the beans. Sorry. Because I'm not going to be there. You know, that I'm leaving. So that visitor character, it often appears in the recent films anyway, that whether it's only the camera that is the visitor, the camera happens to be there as a visitor, or it's me, the I that is obviously not pin downable, because there's no one I. I mean, even when you use I, or you say that it's, you know, I wouldn't presume to say I know Sarah Pusel.
No.
I mean,
there's something about materiality that we talked about anyway.
We're nearly out of time, so I just wanted to ask if there was anything you want, any questions you wanted to ask, or anything you wanted to say yourselves. On the festival Sinando?
Yeah.
So if you've got festival accreditation,
I think it's not that. You have to go through the experimental group thing, don't you?
It's easy to find if you go search the tag for short film button.
Oh, okay.
But it is
tagged on the screen, so it's a search. Okay. That's cool. So, well, that's very... you've said so much, and which just, it's like your work, really. You know, it's sort of, the layering just becomes more and more to talk about. The more you talk, it feels the more there is to talk about. But I'm afraid we do need to break it there. But it certainly isn't a finish. It needs a continuation, doesn't it? So I'm really pleased it's been such a fruitful discussion, because, as I say, you wouldn't necessarily put your two pieces together, but I really felt that there were real sort of commonalities in terms of the kind of conversations, discourses mm. that can mm. come out of putting them mm. together, and that's mm. certainly proved to be the case, I think. So it's
thank you
very much.
Thank you for bringing us together.
Yeah.
And for showing
you.
The film.
Yeah, thank you. Yes. And thank you very much for coming. I hope you've enjoyed it and it's been some food for thought, and you'll go away and see some films by Ruth and Sarah. So fabulous. And enjoy the rest of the festival.